This fourth seminar is entitled The Battle for Jerusalem, the Eternal Capital of the Jews, question mark. Because many evangelicals, especially in America, accept unthinkingly the Zionist mantra that Jerusalem is the undivided, eternal and exclusive capital of the State of Israel. However, Jerusalem existed before the time of the Israelites, and today Jerusalem lies at the heart of three world faiths, Judaism, Islam and Christianity. Israelis regard it as their capital. Palestinians do so also, and attempts to reach agreement in the wider Arab-Israeli conflict have partly stumbled over the contested status of Jerusalem. Jewish Zionists and their Christian supporters are strongly opposed to joint sovereignty or the recognition of East Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine. It seems time is on their side because the annexation of the Old City, the aggressive and illegal settlement program, the systematic demolition of many Arab homes and the construction of a separation barrier have all created facts on the ground in Jerusalem. But Christians and Jewish Zionists claim a higher mandate for this agenda, the Word of God. In this seminar, we're going to consider why Jerusalem is so important to Christian Zionists and why they feel it can only be the exclusive capital of Israel. Then we're going to examine the place of Jerusalem in the Old Testament and in particular some of the prophecies of Isaiah and Zechariah. Then we shall see what Jesus and the apostles have to say about the place of Israel in the Old Covenant and especially the end times. Let's begin by getting a feel for the passion that Christian Zionists so often have for Jerusalem. Following the Arab-Israeli War of 1967, Billy Graham's father-in-law, Nelson Bell, reflected on the sentiments of many American Christians when he wrote, quote, "For the first time in more than 2,000 years, Jerusalem is now completely in the hands of the Jews. It gives the student of the Bible a thrill and a renewed faith in the accuracy and validity of the Bible." 4 years after the capture of Jerusalem in June 1971, Carl Henry, then editor of Christianity Today and considered the dean of American evangelical theologians, hosted a gathering in Jerusalem of over 1,200 evangelical leaders from 32 different countries. Welcomed by David Ben-Gurion, the conference was billed as, quote, "the first conference of its kind since AD 59. Speakers included W.A. Criswell, Harold Ochniger, and John Welford, and they celebrated the regathering of Israel from the ends of the earth with the capture of Jerusalem. These events were seen as confirmation that Jews and Israel still had a role to play in God's ordering of history and that the return of Jesus was imminent. Well, the wider international community saw things rather differently. In protest at Israel's unilateral annexation of East Jerusalem and the West Bank, the United Nations passed Resolution 242, calling on Israel to withdraw its troops to the June 1967 borders and end its occupation. And refusing to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, the few remaining government embassies there were closed and relocated to Tel Aviv. But that's why in 1980, the International Christian Embassy was founded to express solidarity with Israel and recognize a divine blessing in the reunification, as they saw it, of Jerusalem under Israeli sovereignty. At their International Christian Zionist Congress in 1996, they signed a declaration in which they stated, quote, "Because of the sovereign purposes of God for the city, Jerusalem must remain undivided under Israeli sovereignty, open to all peoples, but the capital of Israel only, and all nations should concur and place their embassies here." In 1997, the ICEJ also gave support to a full-page advert placed in the New York Times entitled "Christians Call for a United Jerusalem," signed by 10 leading evangelicals, including Pat Robertson, Oral Roberts, Jerry Falwell, Ed McAteer, and David Alan Lewis. They insisted, quote, "We, the undersigned Christian spiritual leaders, communicating weekly with more than 100 million Christian Americans, are proud to join together in supporting the continued sovereignty of the State of Israel over the holy city of Jerusalem." They went on to say, "We support Israel's efforts to reach reconciliation with its Arab neighbors, but we believe that Jerusalem or any portion of it shall not be negotiable in the peace process. Jerusalem must remain undivided as the eternal capital of the Jewish people." They believe that this will be achieved by the implementation of the US Jerusalem Embassy Act, which legislates for the return of the US Embassy to Jerusalem. Apparently, funds have been allocated, but for more than 10 years, successive US presidents have vetoed the legislation on the grounds of national security. Mike Evans, an outspoken critic, said, quote, "Each time the national security waiver is signed, we're saying to the terrorists and bigots, you win. America needs the blessings of God more than the favor with Arab bigots. Mr. Bush needs to send a signal to all the would-be Osamas that the party is over. No longer will America allow terrorists to threaten our nation into choosing political expediency over moral clarity." He clearly believes that the US should move their embassy to Jerusalem. In fact, John Hagee, the pastor of this megachurch in San Antonio, Texas, says that the special status afforded the Jewish people by God supersedes the rule of international law. He writes this, "A shared Jerusalem? Never. A shared Jerusalem means control of the holy city would be wrested away from the Jewish people and given to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. I say never because the word of God says it's God's will for Jerusalem to be under the exclusive control of the Jewish people until Messiah comes. He doesn't care what the UN thinks. He gave Jerusalem to the nation of Israel, and it's theirs." Well, let's test this theory that Jerusalem is the exclusive capital of the Jewish people. What do the scriptures actually say? Well, if we begin with Jerusalem in the Old Testament, we find that the story goes way back to Genesis. It's probable that Jerusalem was the home of Melchizedek, the priest and king who blessed Abraham in Genesis 14, because he's referred to as the king of Salem, which later became identified with Jewish tradition as Jerusalem. Mount Moriah, where Abraham offered Isaac as a sacrifice, is later identified in 2 Chronicles 3 as the place where Solomon built his temple. So clearly, Jerusalem had an existence long before the conquest of the land by the Israelites. Joshua 15:63 tells us we find the Jebusites already living in Jerusalem and willing to share the city with the new Jewish immigrants. By the time King David turns it into his capital, the capture is achieved with minimal casualties, and it's possible that Zadok, David's high priest, was a Jebusite. Zedek is a Jebusite god of justice. So when Israel celebrated the trimillennial of Jerusalem, the city of David, in 1996, under the banner of Jerusalem 3000, there was some legitimacy in the counterclaim launched by the Palestinian Authority to Jerusalem 5000. Clearly, the building of the temple in Jerusalem by David's son Solomon elevated the status of the city among the tribes of Israel. However, when God judged Solomon for his idolatry and his empire was split in two by Rehoboam and Jeroboam, Jerusalem diminishes in importance and becomes just the capital of the tribe of Judah. As Peter Walker admits, the city designed to bring unity now points instead to division. Nevertheless, the belief grew that Jerusalem was invincible because God dwelt in the temple, his anointed king was on the throne. And yet prophets such as Micah 3:9, Jeremiah 7:1-11, warned against such arrogance. Jeremiah highlights one of the popular mantras of the day. Quote, "Do not trust in the deceptive words and say, this is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord." Jeremiah 7:4. Indeed, the prophet predicted that far from defending Jerusalem in a holy war, God was actually going to be her enemy. Jeremiah 21:3. The prophecies against Jerusalem came true in the capture and destruction of the city by the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar in 587 BC. The prophetic message is clear. God holds his people morally accountable and will tolerate neither arrogance nor complacency. Authors like Hal Lindsey tend to ignore or minimize these warnings, preferring instead to focus on passages that speak of the significance of Jerusalem. One of these prophecies is found in Zechariah 14. It's frequently cited as evidence that one day all the nations of the earth will come to worship God in a new temple in Jerusalem. This is what Zechariah actually says, Zechariah 14, verse 2. I will gather all the nations to Jerusalem to fight against it. The city will be captured, the houses ransacked, and the women raped. Half of the city will go into exile, but the rest of the people will not be taken from the city. Then the survivors from all the nations who've attacked Jerusalem will go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord Almighty, and celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. Lindsay believes that this prophecy is referring to today and an imminent siege of Jerusalem by the Soviet army rather than what happened in the year 70 AD. This is what he says in Planet Earth, Will Mankind Survive? Quote, there couldn't be a more perfect modern-day description of what was predicted hundreds of years ago in Zechariah. There it tells us that the last war of the world will be started by a dispute over Jerusalem. We've got that dispute right now. As a matter of fact, the West helped guarantee the dispute over Jerusalem by forcing the Israelis into a pact with the Palestinians. Well, it was probably Sarah Schofield who first popularized the idea that the Russians will attack Jerusalem in fulfillment of this prophecy. That destruction should fall at the climax of the last mad attempt to exterminate the remnant of Israel in Jerusalem, he writes. Well, how much of Jerusalem will be left standing when Jesus returns is rather a matter of speculation, given Lindsay's terrifying descriptions of the War of Armageddon. But more about this in our last seminar. He writes this, the Bible makes clear that Jerusalem, the focal point of the end times fighting, will be vanquished by Israel's enemies in the hours just before the Lord comes. In fact, it seems that the destruction of the holy city is the final straw that angers God and provokes Jesus' return. Now, before we get carried away by this rather colourful interpretation of Zechariah, let's look again at the text. Remember that ultra-literalism is like a sword. It cuts both ways. Notice that the purpose for going up to Jerusalem, at least in Zechariah's day, is to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles, something the International Christian Embassy does every autumn in preparation, as they see it, to the fulfillment of this prophecy. But if you know your Old Testament feasts, you'll know that the Feast of Tabernacles involves offering a rather large number of animal sacrifices. See Numbers 29 for the kind of sacrifices expected, bulls, rams, and lambs, and lots of them. If that makes you feel a little nervous, and it should, check out verse 15, where Zechariah describes the mode of transportation to be used. Horses, mules, camels, and donkeys. This perhaps gives us a clue that Zechariah is describing events close to his own day, or using contemporary imagery to describe future events surrounding the return of Jesus, and the details of which, like the animal sacrifices, the military tactics, and the means of transport, we don't need to take literally. They're there to encourage readers to trust in God's Messiah who will overthrow evil and establish God's rule on earth forever. What Zechariah predicts, the heathen nations coming to worship the one true God, is developed in the Psalms and Isaiah. Let me give you a foretaste of this from Psalm 87. We have a picture of a shared Jerusalem. It's an international and an inclusive city where residency rights are determined by God on the basis of faith, not race. Psalm 87. He has founded his city in the holy mountain. The Lord loves the gates of Zion more than all the other dwellings of Jacob. Glorious things are said of you, city of God. I will record Rahab and Babylon among those who acknowledge me, Philistia too, and Tyre along with Cush, and will say, this one was born in Zion. Indeed, of Zion it will be said, this one and that one was born in her, and the Most High himself will establish her. The Lord will write on the register of the peoples, this one was born in Zion. As Colin Chapman has observed, this is a message which must have challenged many nationalistic prejudices, and one might add, still does. Isaiah's vision of Jerusalem is of an inclusive one, an inclusive city. Many different nations coming to Jerusalem, putting their faith in God, walking in his ways. One of the glorious consequences of this is the way that Jerusalem becomes associated with the end of war and with peace and reconciliation among the nations. The glorious future of Jerusalem is therefore one that impacts and benefits the world. God's vision is of an inclusive and shared Jerusalem in which the nations, just as much as the Jewish people, are blessed. So despite what some would have us believe, the Old Testament vision of Jerusalem in the future is an international, shared, inclusive city of faith, hope, and love. But what does the New Testament have to say about Jerusalem? What does the New Testament add to this vision? Well, there's good news and bad news. First, the bad news. It may surprise you to learn that the New Testament is rather pessimistic about the fate of Jerusalem. Far from promising a prosperous future at the center of a revived Jewish state or even a millennium kingdom, Jesus lamented the impending destruction of Jerusalem. Luke's Gospel provides us with several insights into the passion of Jesus for Jerusalem. Luke 13, we find Jesus rebuking the leaders of Israel for not caring for the people in a way he does and predicting that he must die there. Evoking the language of Jeremiah, Jesus laments, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you kill the prophets, you stone those sent to you. How often I've longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you are not willing. Look, your house has left you desolate. I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" Luke 13, 34, 35. Quoting Psalm 118, Jesus draws attention perhaps to a psalm in which, a few verses earlier, there is an enigmatic reference to his messianic role. Psalm 118:22, "The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone." In the preceding verses, Jesus contrasts his motives with those of Herod and the leaders of Jerusalem. He displays the instincts of a mother, a protective mother, concerned for the people of Jerusalem as if they were his very children. A little later, on Palm Sunday, Jesus expresses perhaps his strongest emotions toward the city and its fickle people. As he approaches Jerusalem, he sees the city, he weeps over it and says, if you had only known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes. The days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you. They will encircle you and hem you in on every side. They will dash you to the ground, you and your children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you. Luke 19, 41 to 44. Jesus is using the language of Isaiah and Ezekiel to warn God's impending judgment, Isaiah 29:3, Ezekiel 4:2. Now, if you were there and you'd heard Jesus make that prediction, would you have imagined he was describing your generation or events thousands of years later? With the tragic destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, stone by stone, the slaughter of tens of thousands of Jews and their exile of the remnant as slaves of Rome, Jesus' sad prediction came true to the letter. But what about Luke 21:24, you may be thinking? The times of the Gentiles, because this is a favorite verse among Zionist Christians, because they believe it describes the events of June 67 and justifies the subsequent occupation and annexation of the old city. Here are the words of Jesus in context. Luke 21:20-28. "When you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, you will know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those in the city get out, and let those in the country not enter the city. For this is the time of punishment in fulfillment of all that has been written. How dreadful it will be on those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. There will be great distress in the land and wrath against this people. They will fall by the sword. They will be taken as prisoners to the nations. Jerusalem will be trampled on by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. There will be signs in the sun, the moon, and the stars. On the earth, nations will be in anguish, perplexity at the roaring and tossing of the sea. People will faint from terror, apprehensive of what is coming on the world, for the heavenly bodies will be shaken. At that time they will see the Son of Man coming in the cloud with power and great glory. When these things begin to take place, stand up and lift up your heads, because your redemption is drawing near." Luke 21:20-28. Hal Lindsey and Mike Evans are just two of many contemporary prophecy experts who believe this passage is referring to our generation. In 1994, Lindsay was claiming, "We are literally witnessing the end of the times of the Gentiles." A year later, he was a little bit more specific. Quote, "We are literally witnessing the last hours of the times of the Gentiles. God's focus is shifting back to his people Israel." But Mike Evans goes a little bit further, suggesting the times of the Gentiles are actually now over. He says in his book, Jerusalem Betrayed, quote, "Through the centuries, this prophecy has stood as an immovable mark by which we may gauge the often confusing events of Jewish history. Jesus' words spoken so long ago make the city's recapture by the Jews the single most prophetic event in history. The time of the Gentiles is now past, and there has been a changing of the guard. Men may argue and pontificate, but something irrevocable has happened. Jerusalem is no longer trodden down by non-Jews. History has turned a corner, even if few have noticed it." Now, what Evans and others have done with this passage is what might be described as exegesis by contemporary events. That is, reading back into Scripture subsequent events in history. The various editions of the Scofield Reference Bible provide a good example of this tendency. Let's look at the footnote to Luke 21:24, the times of the Gentiles, in 1917 and then in 1984. In 1917, Scofield says, quote, "The times of the Gentiles began with the captivity of Judah under Nebuchadnezzar, since which time Jerusalem has been under Gentile overlordship." By 1984, the footnote becomes, quote, "The times of the Gentiles began with the captivity of Judah under Nebuchadnezzar. Since that time, Jerusalem has been, as Christ said, trampled on by the Gentiles." Frankly, even with the benefit of hindsight, this is a rather weak basis for believing that there will be a future restoration of Jewish sovereignty over Jerusalem. Let me explain. In Revelation 11:2, we're told that the Gentile trampling of Jerusalem would continue for 42 months. Now, if we take this literally as meaning 3.5 years, dating this event is somewhat problematic. Is it past, is it present, or is it future? Perhaps it's not surprising that Scofield doesn't link this passage to Jesus' prophecy. It's far more likely, as the NIV Study Bible suggests, that the times of the Gentiles is a conventional symbol for a limited period of time of unrestrained wickedness. If you reread the context of Luke 21:24, you will see that in the preceding verses and even the first part of verse 24, Jesus is referring to events that occurred in AD 70. In verses 25 to 27, Jesus specifies cataclysmic events that will be associated with his return. Verse 28, Jesus gives encouragement to his followers, referring to your redemption, not to any redemption of unbelieving Jerusalem. It's therefore perhaps far wiser to follow commentators like Norman Geldenhuys, who suggests that the times of the Gentiles will not be fulfilled until the end of this present world order, when Christ will come with his divine majesty and power to establish his eternal kingdom in a new heaven and a new earth. Colin Chapman suggests an even simpler interpretation. The times of the Gentiles just means the time allowed to the Romans. In this sense, Jesus' words are a warning against Jewish pride in their city as much as Gentile arrogance in their military power. Both will be humbled on the day of judgment. It's also significant that Jesus uses the word trampled to describe the effect of Gentile control, because it's a word God uses repeatedly to describe his judgment. For example, in Isaiah 63, he says, "I have trodden the winepress alone, for the nations no one was with me. I trampled them in my anger and trod them down in my wrath. It was for me the day of vengeance. The year for me to redeem had come. I trampled the nations in my anger. In my wrath I made them drunk and poured their blood on the ground." Isaiah 63, 3-6. So if this is the context for Jesus' use of that expression, then we learn from Isaiah that even the most powerful of human tyrants and empires are subject to God's sovereign will, and that in some mysterious way they fulfill his purposes and his judgment. Jesus' statement in Luke 21:24 was therefore not intended to fuel end-time speculation, but rather to encourage sober reflection on how we should live in the light of God's sovereign rule and judgment. In his death and resurrection, Jesus has brought redemption and restoration to all Jews and Gentiles who believe in him. As Peter Walker observes in his book, Jesus and the Holy City, quote, "As for the future of Jerusalem, the apocalyptic discourse revealed that at the end, the central focus would not be upon Jerusalem, but upon the Son of Man. If there was any connection with Jerusalem, it consisted in the fact that the end would be modeled typologically upon Jerusalem's destruction. The restoration was of Jesus, not of Jerusalem." The challenge the apostles faced was proclaiming this good news among the very people who'd crucified Jesus. Despite the brutal power of the Roman occupation, the Jewish religious leaders in Jerusalem continued to exert immense influence over the Jews living throughout the Roman world. And this tension spills over into the early church. In his letter to the Galatians, Paul criticizes the legalists who'd come from Jerusalem and who were infecting the church in Galatia with their mixture of law and grace and emphasis on circumcision. It appears they placed an undue emphasis in the significance of Jerusalem in determining Christian orthodoxy. But as we've seen already, Paul isn't impressed. He compares Jerusalem with Hagar and slavery rather than Sarah and the freedom found in the gospel. Instead, he points to another, more important Jerusalem. And that brings us to the Jerusalem above, the heavenly Jerusalem. In Galatians 4, 26-27, Paul quotes from Isaiah 54:1 and brings together the concept of the heavenly Jerusalem and the earthly one. Let me read it to you. "But the Jerusalem that is above is free, and she is our mother. For it is written, 'Be glad, O barren woman who bears no children, break forth and cry aloud. You have no labor pains, because more are the children of the desolate woman than of her who has a husband.'" What is Paul saying? Well, he's referring to the earthly Jerusalem, quoted from Isaiah 54, but he's now interpreting that as referring to the new Jerusalem, the home of all who believe in Jesus Christ. It's no longer the capital of Israel. In his commentary, J.C. DeYoung says, Galatians 4:21 represents perhaps the sharpest polemic against Jerusalem in the New Testament. Far from being preoccupied with hopes of a glorification of the earthly Jerusalem, Paul's thoughts represents the most emphatic repudiation of any eschatological hope concerning the earthly city. Paul and the other apostles turn their back on Jerusalem. They look forward to a new Jerusalem. The Apostle John reaches the same conclusion in the book of Revelation. Here, Jerusalem becomes figuratively Sodom and Egypt, Revelation 11:8. The Jerusalem that crucified Jesus at Passover, the Jerusalem that rejected the signs and wonders of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost, the Jerusalem that repudiated the message of the apostles, executes Stephen and James, tries to assassinate Paul, and instigates a great persecution, has become associated with the immorality of Sodom and the oppression of Egypt. So the status of Jerusalem has changed. From now on, the earthly Jerusalem will be associated not with the patriarchs, or with David, or with the temple of Solomon, or even Herod, but with a simple wooden cross and an empty tomb. The coming of Jesus has been its undoing. And here at least is a hint of the good news about Jerusalem in the New Testament. I did say there was good news as well as bad. The good news about Jerusalem has to do with all that Jesus accomplished there. Peter Walker says in Jesus and Jerusalem, "It was Jesus himself who gives us the warrant to view Jerusalem in an entirely new light. Jerusalem could never be the same again now that Jesus has come. Jesus, not Jerusalem, would become the central place within God's purposes, the place around which God's true people would be gathered." And it's here that we have this hint of the heavenly Jerusalem. the focus of the New Testament shifts away from an earthly onto a heavenly Jerusalem, which by faith in Jesus we are already citizens. Hebrews 12, verse 22 puts it into the past tense. But you have come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. Access to heaven no longer has anything to do with an earthly Jerusalem. Jesus began to reveal this change in his conversation with the woman of Samaria. In John 4, he says, "Believe me, woman, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you don't know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming, and has now come, when the true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For they are the kind of worshippers the fathers seek." There is no sense, therefore, in which the image of Jerusalem can possibly be seen as an exclusive city reserved for one race. The image we have in Revelation 21 gives us the consummate picture of Jerusalem. Revelation 21, verse 2. "I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. I didn't see a temple in the city, because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. The city doesn't need the sun or the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives it light, and the Lamb is its lamp. The nations will walk by its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. On no day will the gates ever be shut, for there will be no night there. The glory and the honor of the nations will be brought into it. Nothing impure will ever enter it, nor will anyone who does what is shameful or deceitful, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life." In this one all-consuming vision of Revelation 21, 2 and 22 to 26, God's people now embrace all peoples. God's land encompasses all nations, and God's holy city has become the eternal dwelling place of all who are faithful, the bride of Christ, the wife of the Lamb. And what of the temple? John writes, "I didn't see a temple in the city, because the Lord Almighty and the Lamb are its temple." Revelation 21, 22. And yet it is here that the contradiction between the flow of New Testament revelation and the Zionist agenda is most sharply brought into focus. The expectation of a future Jewish temple is probably the most controversial issue uniting Jewish Zionists and their Christian friends. And that's going to be the subject of our next seminar on the third CD. For now, here's a summary of what we've learned in this seminar about Jerusalem. First, many Christian Zionists defend and justify Israel's annexation of Jerusalem, claiming it is the eternal, undivided, and exclusive capital of the Jews. Secondly, we've seen that Jerusalem did become the capital of Israel briefly under David and Solomon before its decline following the disintegration of tribal alliances and their eventual exile. Thirdly, the Old Testament vision of Jerusalem enjoying God's blessing is of an international and inclusive city of faith, justice, and holiness. And then fourthly, Jerusalem in the New Testament is associated not with Israel, the Jews, or the temple, but with Jesus Christ, his death, and resurrection. Fifthly, the end of the times of the Gentiles, far from being a sign of Jewish national sovereignty, more likely points to the return of Jesus. Six, the Jerusalem that rejected Jesus and his followers is associated with the immorality of Sodom and the oppression of Egypt. And lastly, Christians look forward to a heavenly Jerusalem as their spiritual home. If you wish to explore these subjects in more detail, listen to other audios, watch some videos, or download some of the textual basis for these talks, do visit my website, www.sizers, that's S-I-Z-E-R-S, www.israelsunity.org. But I look forward to dialoguing with you further on the third CD when we explore the coming Last Days Temple.